to read Fair to Lawns before he died. And it has long since been reported that Holmes wrote a marginal note, "This guy," meaning Rex South, "is the best of them all." That's Holmes' estate. They don't have it. We're looking for that. It's well known that Harry Blackmun, the Supreme Court Justice, was a Stout fan. Not necessarily fans of Stout or Wolfe, but a lot of the Supreme Court justices, when they die or when they retire, leave their papers to a library or to an archive, just like Rex Stout left his papers to Boston College, where John McAleer placed them and where they're available to research, and a number of us were there this summer. In the 1950s, two of the Supreme Court justices were Felix Frankfurter and Sherman Minton. Minton, a former senator from Indiana, Frankfurter, the famous former professor from Harvard Law School. There was a completely unimportant case called Remmer against the United States, in which Justice Minton was asked to write the opinion. He circulated, as is done, the first draft of the opinion. And the procedure is that the other justices say, "Yes, I agree," or "No, I don't agree," or "I'll agree if you make these changes." Felix Frankfurter wrote a note to Justice Minton, and it says, "Shay," and he's circled a sentence. I will read you the sentence. It says, "After the jury had returned its verdict, the petitioner learned for the first time that during the trial, a person unnamed had contacted a certain juror."
Oh.
"Mr. Justice Frankfurter writes to Mr. Justice Minton, 'Shea, I made a vow never to agree to any opinion of the court that uses contact as a verb. With respect for the Equal Protection Clause, I cannot countenance an exception here. Signed, FF. And Justice Minton writes back to Justice Frankfurter, "My dear Felix, I have your comments on my circulation of case number 304, Remmer against the United States. I have made the following addition at the end of the opinion. Mr. Justice Frankfurter concurs in the judgment of the court and in the opinion, except that he dissents from the use of the word contact as a verb. But on second thought, to save the printing of the concurrence, I'll change the verb contact." And when you look up the actual decision in Remmer against the United States in the 304th volume of the U.S. reports, it turns out that it says communicated with the juror instead of concurred. Judges, not Supreme Court justices, but lower court judges, have referred to either Stout or Nero Wolfe in published decisions of their courts. This is a decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, which sits in Boston. This is a relatively uninteresting case in which a dispute arises about the meaning of the word nearby. A contract used that word, and the parties quibbled on whether something was nearby to something else. And one of the parties cited the definition of nearby in Webster's Third New International Dictionary as the appropriate place for the court to look. And Judge Woodlock, who sits in Boston, said, "While parties have been," that of course is the dictionary that Mr. Wolfe burned. "While parties have been skeptical about the latitudinarian tendencies of Webster's Third, see generally Herbert Morton, The Story of Webster's Third, The Controversial Dictionary and Its Critics, 1994. See also Rex Stout, Gambit, page 2. Nero Wolfe reported to view Webster's Third as subversive because it threatens the integrity of the English language." This is a criminal case from the District of Massachusetts, 2009. It's, again, not an interesting case in and of itself. This is a case in which the defendant was found guilty of being a felon in possession of a firearm, which is a federal offense. He had moved to suppress the gun on the grounds that his car had been stopped and searched illegally. The procedure in that case is that the judge holds a hearing and he hears the testimony from the police officer who stopped the car about what happened. And Judge O'Toole, also of the federal court in Massachusetts, if we ever go back to Boston College, we need to invite these people, also of the federal court in Massachusetts, Officer Dunford of the Boston Police Department was driving in a marked police cruiser when he observed a red Pontiac proceeding in the opposite direction with one headlight extinguished. Pictures of the defendant's contention was that there was nothing wrong with the headlight. The officer just looked for a reason to stop him. Pictures of the vehicle taken after the stop show that the car's left front headlight was indeed malfunctioning. Criswell's counsel's attempt to highlight to quarrel about whether it was an auxiliary adjacent light that was not working was, as Nero Wolfe would put it, flummery. Here is a case, again, a case of no provision. This is from the District of Columbia Circuit in 1975. The judge is just explaining why he addressed the legal issues before him in a certain order. He says, the terms of my order were intended to track the opinion of the Court of Appeals, to use a locution that Nero Wolfe would not tolerate. And one more, and this is real, it relates. This is an opinion from a state court in Connecticut dealing with a boundary dispute between two additional townships on which one had the power to tax a certain property. And a Judge Beach, about whom I know nothing, writes, this is not an unprecedented occurrence. It is the court's understanding that the House of Mystery writer Rex Stout, creator of Nero Wolfe and the indefatigable Archie Goodwin, was bisected by the New York-Connecticut state line, which is absolutely true. So Wolfe has made a mark in legal circles. Rex Stout also made a mark in the halls of Congress. He testified before Congress at least six times, and I'm not going to have a chance to read from this extensively. Some of these excerpts will be reprinted, most often about copyright issues. Occasionally, or earlier, about the work of a couple of organizations he was involved in. I'll just read you one excerpt where the congressman presiding over the hearing, a Congressman Bryson, says, you mentioned that you are the head of the Authors League. Would you mind mentioning to some of us in the unlettered world a few titles of some of your more prominent writings? Mr. Stout, well, I have written three kinds of works of fiction. One, a few light novels. Second, four what are called serious novels, and all the rest of them have been detective stories. Most of the detective stories have been about a fat guy named Nero Wolfe. Mr. Bryson, would you mention one of each? Mr. Stout, How Like a God, Seat on the Wind, Some Buried Caesar, Fair to Lots. Is that enough, sir? So those are the books that are on top of his head. This was in the mid-60s, so as of then, the Some Buried Caesar and Fair to Lots are the two books that Stout, off the cuff, picked as emblematic. Let me close, and then I'll be happy to take questions, with a non-legal discovery. This is a discovery that was made by Rebecca Stout and her publisher, and reported to us, and we will be with it. Several years ago, Tina Silver noted that there was a difference between the ending of the story Before I Die in the magazine version that was different from the ending of the version that appeared in the book collection, Triplicate. Comparing different published versions of the story and picking up differences is something that the more completest of us like to do. The pioneering work here was done by John McAleer, and if you read the preface to Death Times 3, you'll read how he discovered the Wolfe version of Bitter End, which had been pretty much forgotten because it was originally written as a Tecumseh Fox novel, as well as two other stories in which Stout changed the ending, or changed in one case the entire plot, between the version that appeared in, I think it was the Saturday Evening Post, and the version that was published in a collection. This is not quite at that level. This is a discrepancy between the original printing of the book, Prisoner's Base. This is the original hardcover edition from 1952, I believe it is, so 50 years old next year. And 60 years old next year.
It's okay.
Boy, you're not an accountant. And the first couple of paperbacks faithfully reprint the edition, and then later paperbacks from the 1960s through the 1990s reprint that I suspect many of you all have for the most recent reprinting, omit the last chapter. The last chapter of the book is not, we've been trying to figure out why. The publisher's records don't indicate why. I didn't notice anything specifically looking for it, but I think that we would have noticed it going through the archives in Boston if the publisher had said, dear Rex, can we leave out two pages of your prose for no good reason? We would have said no. My theory is simply that if you compare this paperback version with the previous paperback version, the type is a little smaller. Books are printed in signatures of 16 pages. This version contains four pages of front matter, a copyright notice pages of the back matter, the author note and the ad for other titles, and 154 pages of book. So it may just be that they were trying to make room. But in any case, most of you have read a book, and I'm not going to give away the plot for any of you who haven't read it, but remember that this is a book where Wolf decides he needs to go after the murderer. He doesn't have a client. He goes after the murderer for personal reasons, for reasons because he has been, somebody has been killed basically under his nose, and he's outraged, and he says, I'm going to catch the murderer on his own account. He enlists Archie, of course, to help him. In fact, Archie is more upset than Mr. Wolf. And the book ends, as I always thought, for reading the paperbacks, very abruptly, the last sentence of the version all of us had seen. Then Kramer was there. I'm not going to give away the ending, I promise. Then Kramer was there, and Skinner, the district attorney. And I sidestepped to make room and stood licking blood from my knuckles, he just punched someone, and watching Pearlie get the handcuffs on, and there's the name of the murderer. And that's how the book ends, for most of us. Here's how the book really ends. Did I have one more minute to read the page?
I'm gonna be a minute early.
This is how Prisoner's Base really ends and is supposed to end, and in all future printings, I'm promised, will end again.
The A&E TV series has it.
The A&E TV series has
it. Jane has it.
Yeah, before you read that, would you read the last paragraph of what we think?
I just did.
Okay.
That's the last paragraph. It's one of those setups in Wolf's office where he's naming the murderer, and he names the murderer, and he explains, and of course, there's a completely, you know, we always talk about whether Wolf plays fair with the reader. This is the canonical example of one where he doesn't, and again, I don't want to give away the ending, but some people, something, and not one you can solve, you know, by thinking really hard. And so Wolf says, you know, he's the murderer, events prove that he is the murderer. Pearlie puts the handcuffs on the murderer. Chapter 17. One morning the following week, Wolf entered the office at 11 o'clock, got seated at his desk, removed the paperweight from the little stack of morning mail, and took a look. One of the office rules is that he is to see all incoming checks, whatever the source, before I stamp the endorsement on them and take them to the bank. That morning, there were two. The first one was from a client for whom a confidential errand had been performed 2 months back. Wolf put it aside, picked up the second one, frowned at it, and then at me, and demanded, what the devil is this? You have instructed me, I replied, never to reply to a rhetorical question. But since it's you who ask it, that is my personal check on the Metropolitan Trust Company, dated today to your order for $1,624.37. Do you want me to go further? Yes. You told them that day in the DA's office, Wolf had gone to the DA's office when Archie was a suspect, again, to refresh your memory of the plot. You told them that day in the DA's office that I was your client in this case. And I know what you invariably do to clients when you get their jobs done, especially if you provide fireworks. I have waited 10 days for you to soak me, but you have not given me a bill or told me to make one out. With my fingers crossed, which was an ordeal on account of my sore knuckles, I have made out that check for the amount of the expenses you incurred. There it is. He grunted. Do you remember what I said to Miss Eads about upholding my self-esteem? I do. I remember everything. Very well. I still have it. It's a costly indulgence, but I choose to keep it. He took the check, with thumbs and forefingers at the middle of its top edge, tore it across, put the halves together, and tore again, swiveled and dropped the shreds into the wastebasket. Gee, that's wonderful, I said gratefully. I appreciate that warmly. And knowing how much you value your self-esteem, Mr. Wolf, I want to do all in my power to help you keep it. I myself spent close to $200 that week. Taxis, phone calls, bills for myself and others, incidentals. I haven't put an expense account in for it, but now I will, since you feel so strong. You will not! Not a cent! Okay, well, anyway, it's your self-esteem, not mine. He's a hard guy, please. Well, you are sometimes hard guys to please, but I hope I've done.